Today, I want to bring up a profound question for which I have no profound answers. Even so, I think it's important enough, cutting to the core of how we see ourselves and how we think about one another, to drag out into the light and examine, clear-eyed, unnerving as this may be. I'm referring to the accumulating body of scientific evidence that our sense of making conscious decisions is largely an illusion. Many of our day-to-day choices turn out to be made first by unconscious realms in our minds and only retrospectively rationalized by our conscious selves, unaware that the conscious self is just along for the ride. What, as individuals and as a congregation of spiritual seekers, do we make of this? How can we navigate this understanding and still love and help and support one another, even if, as we accept how limited is even our awareness, let alone control? Of course, there's nothing new in the intuitive understanding that we're not always aware of our own thoughts. Strange as this seems to say, ancient stories speak knowingly of being inhabited by all sorts of spirits, no doubt conveying in part the sense we have all had at something we do or think or say that takes us by surprise. Where did that come from? And for at least as long as people have been writing down stories, and no doubt far longer than that, we see tales of love-struck couples where the only ones blind to what is actually being felt are the couples themselves. Clearly, the understanding that there is more to the self than the conscious self goes way back. In our scientific age, one of the sweeping themes has been the continuing displacement of humankind from the center of all things. The Copernican Revolution pushed us out of the center of the universe. The Darwinian Revolution displaced us from the pinnacle of creation. And then along comes Freud to point out that even our own minds are largely off limits to us. I think it would be hard to overstate how threatening this is to orthodox religious morality. How do we, and God, hold people morally culpable for actions driven by thoughts and feelings deliberately hidden from their consciousness by unconscious actors within their minds? The problem is even more acute in religious traditions like the Catholic Church in which I was raised, where not just actions, but also thoughts and feelings, and even thoughts and feelings about one's own thoughts and feelings, can be sinful. The comedian George Carlin, in his monologue, The Confessional, describes in detail how many sins he, as an adolescent boy, committed with a single unchaste act. Stancy has advised me not to go anywhere near telling this story from the pulpit, but you can look it up. All I'm going to say here is that as a former altar boy myself, his list is not anywhere near complete. All of this helps explain some of the hostility that much of mainstream religion has shown toward modern psychology. But cognitive science has upped the ante further in the late 20th century, with data suggesting that not only do we have thoughts of which we are unaware, but worse yet, we make decisions that we think are conscious, but in reality are not. Benjamin Libet, a psychologist at the University of California at San Francisco, published a study in the mid-1980s when Stancy and I were there in grad school with a shocking result. People were given a simple task, such as pushing a button, whenever they decided to do so on their own. They were told to note from the position of a dot on an oscilloscope when they decided to push the button. Simultaneously, electroencephalograms were measured brain activity. The eye-opening result was that one could see the brain activity of the decision several tenths of a second before people were aware that they'd made the decision. This result provoked a firestorm. The straightforward interpretation was that the impression of a conscious decision, and perhaps free will itself, was a mirage. Decisions were being made unconsciously and then retrospectively recognized and claimed by the conscious mind. Headlines in the general science press, I recall from back then, featured tabloid-style headlines like "The Myth of Free Will." Now, as a scientist, I should say that these sort of experiments are actually very difficult to nail down conclusively. There are almost always alternative ways of interpreting the data. And I should say I'm venturing out of my own home territory in the more microscopic realms of biology to areas of psychology where several members of the congregation understand these issues more fully than I. That said, I think it is fair to say that the last few decades of ever more precise experiments has overall confirmed, consolidated, and even extended Libet's basic findings, that a substantial fraction of what feels to us as conscious decision-making is really retrospective rationalization of what has already been unconsciously decided. Phyllis referred last week to the old joke that Unitarians would rather go to a discussion group about heaven than just go to heaven, so I don't want to fall into that trap and turn this into a lecture on cognitive psychology, a topic I'm not even competent to cover. I really want to delve into the question of how we deal with this unsettling knowledge in our own lives and in our shared community. You know, here I will just say that Libet's original experiments have been confirmed and extended over the years as technology improves. For example, in 2008, the laboratory of John Dylan Haynes at the Max Planck published an update of the Libet experiment in the prestigious journal Nature Neurosciences, where they describe having subjects in a specialized kind of magnetic resonance imager to press a button with either their left hand or their right hand and note when they made the decision. The researchers found that they could see from brain activity which hand the subject would use several seconds before the subjects were aware that they'd even made a decision. Many other related experiments with different tasks and different measurements shore up the basic finding and help exclude alternative hypotheses. But just as modern cognitive science opens up this dizzying and disruptive view of ourselves, I think it offers clues forward to ways of using this knowledge personally, socially, and spiritually. For example, last year, J. David Creswell's group at Carnegie Mellon published a remarkable study where they gave people a complex task, such as trying to decide which was the best car to buy from a complicated presentation of features, prices, reviews, etc. Again, they watched the MRI scanners, which brain areas were activated, while the subject grappled with the decision. Then they gave subjects a two-minute distracting task that occupied their conscious mind and stopped them from being consciously aware of any other thoughts. The first interesting result is that even as the conscious mind was distracted, the same areas of the brain activated by trying to decide about the cars kept going, presumably churning away at the data unbeknownst to the subjects themselves. The second, even more important result was that the subjects, given a distracting task, made better decisions about the car than the subjects who just continued to think consciously about the data for the 2 minutes where some of the subjects were being distracted. Even more amazing, the researchers found they could predict to a significant degree which subjects would make the best decision from the degree into which their prefrontal cortices kept going during the distraction. I think these amazing findings start to give us an in toward thinking for ourselves what to make of all this. First and foremost, this new understanding gives us a positive way to accept and even embrace our now more accurate assessment of our own consciousness. To be sure, it is a demotion from captain of the soul, but the conscious mind is still an essential member of the crew, not a mere helpless passenger. Back in college, long before any of these experiments were done, at a time that I worried I was coming unglued myself, I wrote a poem called Second Lieutenant of My Soul. Now long lost, which is probably just as well. Now we can see that consciousness is one of the key tools the larger mind uses to make its way in the world, but that it acts as part of a greater self that can do most things better than we can consciously, working on many problems at once in a way that consciousness cannot. Consciousness is at least in part what the mind as a whole deploys to deal with novelty, where its usual experience and intuition are not helping. Okay, take a look at this, I imagine the mind saying, as it fires up the consciousness app to focus hard on a difficult but contained question. In the meantime, I'll carry on with the dozens of other ordinary tasks that are needed to keep us in one piece. Next, I think the phenomenon of unconscious decision-making really does pose a fundamental challenge to traditional religious morality. Far too many people are made by their religions to feel horrible about themselves for the way they are and how they live their day-to-day lives. I believe that we, as a religious tradition, committed to both acceptance of one another and to learning from many sources, including natural science, have a special responsibility to push back against this and to point out how science is showing us the limited role of our conscious decisions in our overall lives. In other words, we are who we are, and the data say we should cut each other a little slack. That said, how do we hold ourselves and one another responsible for treating each other with compassion and respect? Years ago, in a lay service on free will, I talked about the philosopher Daniel Dennett's notion of the intentional stance. That is, taking a stance to act as if one did possess free will, and how that tends to help us make better choices. Answering this question has implications in areas as wide-ranging as couples counseling to the penal code. I struggled a bit trying to choose examples here, since many of the most serious ones seem too dark. You can no doubt imagine cases where the idea that a decision was made unconsciously might change how you thought about how to respond. Just to take a common example, ill-chosen words that can seem to come from out of nowhere, out of our mouths, almost certainly are picked and acted upon by unconscious actors in our own minds. And perhaps we should give people sometimes a pass for these. What then can we, that is, our conscious selves, do in the service of our whole selves and our community of selves? Superior as it is at dealing with huge, messy, complex data sets, the unconscious mind is not very good at other things, long-range planning, for example, or anticipating the consequences of our decision. The conscious self may not be able to stop something we do if the action has already been carried out by the time we become aware the decision has been made, but it can, within its limited ability to attend to multiple things, say, well, the last few times that did not turn out well, so I'm going to stay clear of situations where that bad decision is even an option. This is what people do intuitively when, say, dieters keep fattening food out of the house, or recovering drug addicts stay away from people and places connected with their drug use. The only difference now is that instead of seeing this as being weak-willed, we realize that it is at least as often the unconscious mind slipping one by the conscious, which is only able to attend to a few things at a time. We may cut someone slack for the occasional lapse, but we can hold them and ourselves responsible for staying away from situations where the risk of lapse is high. Finally, although our conscious minds can't command the much larger forces within us, that is to say, we cannot influence them, we do have some ability to activate or suppress them. For example, when we imagine in detail the likely consequences of some action we know that elements of the unconscious want, perhaps because we have gone there in the past and regretted it, we activate preconscious parts of ourselves, for example, our senses of fairness and compassion, and let them do battle with other parts of ourselves seeking gratification in other ways. The Harvard linguist and psychologist Steven Pinker, co-opting the memorable phrase from Abraham Lincoln's first inaugural, wrote that although we cannot choose our nature, we can pit the better angels of our nature against the others, and thereby make progress to a more just, peaceful, and compassionate society. I actually feel that my own subconscious selves sometimes play this game against one another, for example, pitting my sense of duty against more reckless impulses. Once our conscious selves settle into accepting our more modest but still crucial roles on the ship of the larger self, we can better help ourselves and one another. Perhaps not captain of the soul, but with a key part in navigation and even occasionally with a place at the helm. Make it so. Our closing hymn is number 1020 in the Turquoise book, Voyage.